Does God exist? I hope you won't be disappointed if I say that that's a question that can't be settled adequately in a 40-minute talk. So I won't try to settle it. What I'll do instead is less ambitious, but I hope helpful nonetheless. I'll explore the possibilities and limits for using philosophy to learn about God's existence. Unsurprisingly, since this is organized by the Thomistic Institute, I'll be presenting things in a way that more or less jives with Thomas Aquinas' approach. But I won't be doing that because I was invited by the Thomistic Institute. I'll be doing it because I think it makes good sense. Here's the order in which I'll be presenting things. First, I'll give a brief sense of what philosophy is in the first place. Second, I'll give brief discussions of reasons for believing in God other than as the result of philosophical argumentation. Third, I'll discuss the idea of believing in God on the basis of philosophical argumentation. Fourth, I'll briefly look at objections to God's existence. Fifth, I'll consider the following question. If we have used philosophy to overcome objections to God's existence and to provide philosophical reasons for believing in God, what comes next, philosophically speaking? And sixth, I'll point out the limitations of philosophy when it comes to God. Here is a quick account of what philosophy is, section one. It's the use of reason, unaided by divine revelation, to investigate the most foundational questions. In saying unaided by divine revelation, I mean that philosophy doesn't rely on the Bible or any other revelation from God, but instead just tries to figure things out by human reason alone. What I mean by saying the most foundational questions can be explained using the following example. If I ask you what the past tense of jump is, you'll tell me that it's jumped. If I ask you why it's jumped and not jump, you'll tell me something about two types of verbs in English. If I ask you what a verb is, you'll say something about action or something like that. If I ask you what words are, you'll say something about sounds that express thoughts or whatever. The relevant point here is simply that these questions keep getting at more and more basic or more foundational questions. They keep getting deeper and deeper. The deeper or more foundational a question is, the more quote-unquote philosophical it is. Probably there's no precise line between the questions that are philosophical and the questions that are not. But if you get as far as asking whether God exists, you're clearly in philosophy territory. Our question then is whether we can know that God exists, and also whether we can know it solely on the basis of natural human reasoning powers, whether we can know it philosophically, in short. Now, the purpose of this talk is to think about how we might come to believe in God on the basis of philosophical argumentation, but partly for the sake of completeness and partly for the sake of contrast, I want to indicate some of the ways we might come to believe in God other than by philosophical argumentation. The fact that they aren't the same as philosophical argumentation doesn't automatically make them bad, of course. They have their strengths and their weaknesses. I'm not going to say much about that here. So a first way we might come to believe in God in a non-philosophical manner would be by accepting God's existence on human authority, the authority of our parents, for example, or on the basis of the fact that nearly all humans have believed in God in the course of history, in some sense. relying on the authority of other people is not always wrong. For one thing, sometimes there's just no alternative. But from the philosophical standpoint, it's a pretty weak kind of support. A second way we might come to believe in God, again, non-philosophically, would be on the basis of experiencing God. Suppose that in some way, I've had an encounter with God and thereby come to know that God exists, even maybe something about like what God is like. The question of whether we can experience God is extremely complicated. If God is what Christians say, then probably we can't experience God by means of our natural powers, because God totally transcends our powers. Think of ultraviolet radiation, which falls outside of what human vision can see. Or think of the Earth's magnetic field, which sea turtles can sense, but which we can't. Well, God is outside of what we experience. And in a more radical way, so if people can experience God, it looks like it's only because God himself intervened to make this possible. We can't just spot God. He has to make his presence available to us. Now, whether this can happen and what to make of it when it does happen is an important question, but it falls outside the topic of this talk. Obviously, we can reflect philosophically on the possibility of experiencing God. We're doing it right now. And we can reflect on what such experiences might mean, but that would all be reflection on the basis of something that originally happened supernaturally, and therefore it's not really philosophy in the sense that I outlined earlier. A third way we might come to believe in God would be through divine faith. By this I mean accepting something on God's own authority. He reveals it, and therefore we accept it. And we are moved to do so by God's own operation on our mind and will. God teaches us something, and he also moves us to accept that teaching on his say-so, rather than because we can conclusively see it for ourselves. Faith, in this special sense, is the starting point for the science of theology, which is often understood to be faith-seeking understanding. We accept things on faith, and then we go on to reflect on them in the hope of understanding them better. The idea that there could be faith in this sense is far from crazy, in my opinion. And if there is faith in this sense, then obviously it would be a great thing to have it. What more reliable starting point could there be than revelation from God? But I'm not going to say much more about that in this talk, because accepting things on divine faith is not a philosophical method of inquiry. Now I want to get to the main part of this talk, namely, believing in God's existence on the basis of philosophical argument. Can we come to believe in God without relying on divine revelation or any other authority, and without having had any spiritual or mystical experiences, but simply on the basis of philosophical reasoning? One way to try this would be to start with a definition or conception of God, and then to come to the realization that God is just the sort of thing that has to exist, that it's self-contradictory to suppose that God doesn't exist. To put this mode of argument in an extremely crude form, think of it like this. If the word God means a perfect being, then obviously God must exist, because if he didn't exist, he wouldn't be perfect, but then he wouldn't be God. Now, as I say, this is not a very sophisticated version of the argument, so if you're not impressed, that's okay. Better versions are available, but Aquinas thinks, for what it's worth, that even in a good version, arguments like this don't work. Aquinas' strategy is very different. For one thing, he doesn't start with a definition of God at all. Aquinas thinks that we can't really get an adequate definition of God. We can't figure out what the divine essence is. God is too transcendent, too far above us. It just doesn't work. So instead, Aquinas begins with only a very minimal, rough and ready notion of God. What's more, when laying out his arguments, Aquinas doesn't start by discussing that rough notion of God. He leaves it unmentioned and on the back burner. Instead, he talks about the everyday world. How can we get from reflecting on the everyday world to the notion of God? In the thousands of pages of writings that Aquinas left us, there are a number of different arguments for God's existence. The most famous are the five arguments he gives in his greatest work, the Summa Theologiae. What these five... Does that mean? So, the most famous of his arguments are the five that he gives in the Summa Theologiae. What these five ways, as everybody calls them, the five ways, what these five ways have in common is the following. They start out with some fact about the world. For example, that things change, or that they act in an orderly fashion. Then, these modes of argument try to bring out the idea that this fact about the world that we started with, the fact that things change or that they act in an orderly way, for example, that these facts can't be explained unless something exists that is, at least in some respect, perfect. So from this, Aquinas concludes that this being exists. Then he says that the word that humans use for this kind of being is God. So like the God bit shows up right at the very last second. Now, what I've just done is I've stated this mode of argument very, very abstractly. Just like all, like with abstractly. So what I want to do is walk through two examples and give you a much better idea of how it works. What I'll be doing is giving you simplified versions of two of the five ways. They are simplified, and I feel obliged to state that. But it's okay, because like I'm not trying to give definitive versions. I'm trying to give you a feel for his strategy. So I'm going to start by looking very briefly at the fifth argument, the fifth way. It argues from order in the universe. Things in the universe, Aquinas says, act in a goal-oriented way. They don't just operate at random, but instead they operate very consistently in a way that always or almost always results in a good outcome. This is a familiar fact, but it should strike us as weird, because most things in the universe lack intelligence and consistent behavior. That consistently arrives at a good outcome requires the intelligence of someone who is guiding or directing things. Therefore, says the argument, some intelligent being must exist that directs these beings to their ends. Having reached this point, the point of concluding that some such intelligent directing being exists, Aquinas says, and this being we call God. In other words, he argues for the existence of something that has some very important quality, in this case, a certain kind of intelligence, directed in a certain way. And then he says that any being that fits this description is legitimately called God. Now let's switch gears and look at a rather different argument, namely the first one. It's usually called the argument from motion. But motion, in Aquinas' lingo, doesn't just mean going from one place to another, which is what motion usually means in English. In Aquinas' language, motion means change in general. So I'm going to present the argument by talking about change. Aquinas says that the world around us is full of things that change. And that's obviously correct. He then reflects on the nature of change. Here's an example. It's my example, not Aquinas's. Imagine a tank of cold water. It has the potentiality to become warmer if something acts on it so as to actualize that potentiality. For Aquinas, it's crucial to see that the thing that acts to make the water warmer has to be something other than the water itself. To become warmer, the water needs an influx of energy, and the energy can't come from the water itself. If the water already had that energy, the water would already be warm. So the water has to lack the energy and then receive it from the outside. Now then, let's suppose that the water receives the energy from a heating coil. And let's return our reflections now to that coil. Did it change from not delivering energy to delivering energy? Obviously, yes. It hasn't been shooting out heat from all eternity. Somebody had to warm it up by passing an electric current through it. So the coil changes the water to become warm, but it does so only because it, the coil, has itself been changed. It's a changer of the water, but it's a changed changer. Only because it's been changed by the electricity can the coil change the water from cold to warm. Perhaps you can see where this is going. My next question is going to be about the electricity. Has it just been flowing from all eternity, or did something get it started? Obviously, something did. So the coil is a changed changer, and the electricity is a changed changer too. Can it just go on like this forever? Aquinas says no. Even if some sequences of causes can go on forever, this kind of sequence cannot. In this kind of sequence, the buck has to stop somewhere. There has to be something that brings about change in other things without being itself changed. This special something is an unchanged changer. Or, to put this in the technical language that Aquinas uses, it's an unmoved mover. So at this point, Aquinas has come to the end of his argument. There exists an unchanged changer. And, quoting Aquinas now, this everyone understands to be God. There's an objection that you might make to this line of reasoning. We can make the objection clearer by choosing a different example. Suppose we rig up a fancy Rube Goldberg contraption of the sort that features in that board game that no one actually ever plays, Mousetrap. Does that game still exist? But nobody plays it, right? You just set the thing up. Yeah. Okay, a hammer hits a board, the board knocks over a flower pot, the flower pot falls on a giant clothespin. The giant clothespin opens up to release a rubber band. The rubber band snaps in a way that causes a ball to roll down a ramp, etc., etc. And in the end, something exciting happens, like a bell rings. The last event in this series was caused by the second to last event. The second to last event was caused by the third to last, and so on. Each of the causes, in other words, is a caused cause. Is this the sort of thing that Aquinas is talking about? It is, and it isn't. There's something important to notice about this series of causes. Once the first one does its thing, its job is over. Then the second one does its thing, and its job is over, and so on. If the contraption was large enough that you had sufficient time, you could actually start disassembling it before the process reached its conclusion. It's like a giant row of dominoes. If the row was long enough, you could have the first bunch of dominoes put back into their boxes and stowed in your truck before the last domino fell. Now, why is this important? It's important because Aquinas is not trying to prove that once, long ago, there was a God, and God set the universe in motion. That would, of course, be interesting to prove, but it would leave open the possibility that God had retired or even die. All that would have been proved was that the uncaused cause got the chain of events rolling. It would not have proved that the uncaused cause still exists, nor would it prove that that uncaused cause is still exerting causation. So this pushes us to think more deeply about what Aquinas is actually saying. Like other medieval authors, he distinguishes the Rube Goldberg or domino kind of causal series, which they call an accidentally ordered series, from a different kind of causal series, which they call an essentially ordered causal series. In accidental domino style series, the causes don't operate all at once. But in an essentially ordered causal series, all the causes do operate at once. If the last one is operating now, then so too are the middle ones, and so too is the first one. Aquinas' own example is a hand moving a stick, moving a stone. The stick moves the stone only when the hand is moving the stick. If the hand stops moving the stick will stop moving the stone. Or think of my example of the water tank. The water tank's temperature will rise only when the coil is heating it. If the coil stops heating it, the temperature will stop rising right away. And the coil's being at a certain temperature depends on the flow of current. If the current stops flowing, the coil temperature will start to drop right away. If the details of this example don't work perfectly well, we can adjust the example. The point is not sticks and water tanks. The point is rather that when Aquinas talks about God as the beginning of a causal series, he has in mind the sort of series where all the causes operate at once. And therefore, the argument as he intends it is not vulnerable to the objection that although God might have caused the world to start long ago, we don't have any reason to think that he's still around. That would be a problem if Aquinas was talking about domino causation, but he's not. By the way, this has a rather amazing implication. If Aquinas is right, then at least some of the events that are happening in the world right now are the tail end of processes that begin with divine action. Suppose you see a stick moving a stone, and I am pushing that stick, but it's a very long stick, so I'm in the other room. You can't see me because I'm in the other room, but there's still a sense in which you can see what I'm doing. Well, maybe when we see the sun shining or the rain falling, we are, in a sense, seeing something that God is doing, something that God is doing right now. That's a pretty striking idea. Okay, so much for our look at the first and fifth ways. As I've said, these are only simplified versions of the arguments. Perhaps we'll get beyond some of the simplifications in the discussion period. My point here is simply to try to make clear how Aquinas approaches the topic of arguments for God's existence. He takes some fact about the world, change or consistency, for example, and he argues that this fact couldn't actually exist given only the ordinary beings we have around us. The ordinary beings around us exhibit characteristics that can't be explained without appeal to a very different kind of being. For example, an unchanged being that gets other things to change, or an intelligent being that guides unintelligent beings. In other words, the ordinary facts around us don't make sense unless there is some extraordinary being. As G.K. Chesterton puts it in his biography of Thomas Aquinas, most people think that the imperfections in the world are evidence against the existence of God, but Aquinas thinks they are evidence in favor of the existence of God. The imperfect beings we see around us aren't enough to explain themselves. So it makes sense to conclude that there is some super being that is free of imperfection in such a way that it can be ultimately responsible for everything else. And this extraordinary being is so very extraordinary that it might be safer not to call it a being at all, but something else, like the source of being. Now I want to say a brief word about objections to the God's to the claim that God exists. For Aquinas, as for most medieval philosophers and theologians, it's standard operating procedure not just to state your views and not just to give arguments for your views, but also to state objections to your views and then to answer those objections. Wouldn't it be amazing if politicians did that? Can you just think of it? Aquinas lists two objections to God's existence, and they are probably the two most important ones. First, that there's evil in the world, and that's enough to prove that there isn't any God. Second, that we don't need to believe in God because we already have enough good explanations of everything. In a way, Aquinas' answer to that second objection is already lurking in his arguments in favor of God. Aquinas thinks it's false that we can give ultimate explanations of everything without appealing to God. Of course, we can give explanations of things without talking about God. But those explanations involve appealing to beings that themselves need explanation. When we've done something like that, we have indeed given an explanation, but we haven't given an ultimate explanation. As for the first objection, Aquinas' answer goes well beyond anything contained in his arguments for God's existence. What he says in that particular text that I'm concerned with is short but deep. Someone who thinks that evil is an objection to God apparently thinks that the only proper way for God to deal with evil would be to destroy it. But Aquinas thinks there's another alternative. God can allow evil to exist, but then draw a greater good out of it. There's a lot packed into that thought, but at the very least, I think it shows that the topic of God and evil is more complicated than it originally might appear to be. It is indeed a mysterious idea that God might allow evil rather than just snuff it out. But it seems too quick to say that the existence of evil just flat out disproves God's existence. That's all I'm going to say now about objections. Suppose you've gone and looked up what Aquinas actually says, not my simplified versions. Suppose you've done enough background reading to understand what's really going on in these arguments or similar arguments, maybe from other philosophers. And suppose finally you've concluded that at least one of these arguments has only a minor flaw, a flaw that can be fixed. If you fix the flaw, then you will have a good argument for God's existence. The argument, let's say, would have been inspired by Aquinas and perfected by you. Of course, the authorship of the argument is not very important. What's important is whether it works. Alternatively, you might conclude that none of these arguments works. Like, you might just think none of Aquinas' arguments works. And you might also conclude that the flaws are very deep and that the arguments are just unsalvageable. If you concluded that, then you would not be in a position to conclude that God doesn't exist. There might be some other perfectly good arguments that Aquinas didn't think of. Or maybe no one yet has come up with a good argument. But even then, God might still exist. At any rate, Aquinas would not be mad at you for shooting down his arguments. He thinks that if someone gives a bad argument for the existence of God, we shouldn't act as if everything is okay, because at least they're on the right side. We should shoot the argument down, Aquinas says, because we don't want people thinking that this bad reason is why people believe in God. That would be another amazing cultural change, if people like stopped giving a pass to bad reasons for their own conclusions. If you like policed your own team as well as the other team. These are like radical proposals. Okay, having contemplated the possibility that Aquinas' arguments don't work out, let's think about it more optimistically now. Suppose you come to the conclusion that at least one of the arguments does work, or we already saw something optimistic, right? Maybe we thought we could fix one of the arguments. Okay. Suppose, that you come to the conclusion that there exists an unchanged cause of change. What then? In other words, after proving the existence of God, what comes next, philosophically speaking? The short answer to this question is, you have to keep thinking. Maybe that's good advice in general, although not always. But it has a special meaning here. It's tempting to suppose that once you've proved the existence of an unchanged cause of change, you have thereby proven everything anyone might want to prove about God. It's tempting to think things like this. Hooray! There's an uncaused cause of change. God exists. His son Jesus is my personal savior. The Catholic Church is here to provide me with the fullness of the means of salvation. But if you think about it, all of that stuff goes way, way beyond the actual conclusion that there's an unchanged cause of change. Right? So even though Aquinas uses the word God here, all he means by the word God at this point in the argument is the bare idea of an unchanged cause of change. That's all that's been proved at that point. If that's all that's been proved, then there's a lot that has not yet been proved. For example, Aquinas would not yet have proved that this uncaused cause, this unmoved mover, he would not have proved that it has a mind. He hasn't proved that it created us. He hasn't proved that it loves us. He hasn't even proved that it knows we exist. For all we know from the argument, it's just some kind of force. Now, of course, Aquinas does think that God has a mind, that God created us, and so on. But Aquinas believes those things only because of further philosophical reasoning. Each new point requires its own reasoning. In fact, it takes Aquinas 50 pages of highly compressed writing in small print to arrive at the conclusion that there's only one God. Like, it's amazing. When you get to that, you suddenly realize, oh my gosh, all this time, it's been on the table that maybe there's like hundreds. How does Aquinas take all these extra steps? To answer that question, I have to go through all the steps, right? And we'd be here all night. I won't do that. But I will make one very important point. To a significant extent, the further reasoning that Aquinas goes through is the unfolding of the idea of God that he arrived at in the initial argument. What the arguments have in common is that God is where the buck stops. He's not just a cause, he's an uncaused cause. He gives, but what he gives, he did not receive from somewhere else. He didn't receive it from anywhere else because just by his very nature, he already had it. To put it differently, he's completely perfect. From that insight, Aquinas is able to go on to argue for a lot of things about God. If he's perfect, he needs to have a mind, for example. So while it's true, as I said earlier, that Aquinas' arguments don't right away give us a well-developed idea of a personal God, they do contain the seeds of that idea. And Aquinas gets those seeds to grow by further reflection. Now, assuming that these subsequent arguments, these developments, work, Aquinas' way of doing philosophy can get you some pretty substantial results. It can get you to the idea that God is good, that he's an immaterial spirit, that he's all-powerful, that he knows everything, that he created everything, that he guides everything, and so on. It might even get you to the idea that you should love and reverence God and pray to him. However, it has to be admitted that it can still be a pretty cold and abstract and philosophical sort of religion. No burning bush, no crossing of the Red Sea, no return from captivity in Babylon, no Jesus dying on the cross for our sins, no sending of the apostles to the whole world. This philosophical approach won't get you to anything that most people would call religion. It's a philosophical religion, not a religion. For Aquinas, that requires going beyond philosophy by accepting God's revelation. Revelation goes beyond human reason. It tells us things we could never prove on our own, and it gives us utter confidence about things that would otherwise just be based on our own potentially flawed philosophical reasoning. Now, it might be objected that relying on revelation is acting like a weakling. Shouldn't we do things under our own power? To that, I think Aquinas would give two answers. First, if God is really God, then he's so far above us that it's ludicrous to think we could have a good understanding of him just on the basis of our own powers. Second, humans are weak and flawed. And if Aquinas says so, that counts for something, because very few humans have been as smart and hardworking as Thomas Aquinas. So maybe humans are pretty limited, in which case it would make sense for them to rely on divine help if they can get it. In any case, whether you accept the possibility of divine help or not, it's worthwhile being aware not only of the strengths of philosophical reasoning, but also of the limitations of philosophical reasoning. To do otherwise would be unphilosophical. Okay, just a few concluding remarks. As you can tell from what's been said, Aquinas thinks that philosophical reason has a lot of power to learn about the existence and nature of God. At the same time, he also thinks that philosophical reason has serious limits. Some of those limits are practical. Philosophy takes a lot of time, and it's easy to make mistakes. Some of those limits are limits in principle. God so transcends the human mind that many important truths about God simply cannot be discovered by humans without divine revelation. It's important to see both the power and the limits of philosophical reason. If all we see are the limits, then we'll think that there can't really be any dialogue between Christian believers and non-believers. Religion would be exclusively based on faith, and those who aren't believers, those who don't have the faith, those people would have no access to God, it would seem. No access in any way until they had accepted divine revelation. There's another problem, too, if philosophy has nothing to say about God. Of course, divine revelation is adequate, but it might not always be adequate for us. Revelation is hard to understand. Sometimes the Bible makes you think that God is an immaterial spirit, and then you turn the page and you read something about God's holy arm or his footstool. Philosophical reason can help us come up with intellectually solid and rigorous interpretations of Scripture, which sometimes uses a lot of figurative and metaphorical language. Again, the point isn't that the Bible needs philosophy, but that we need philosophy to understand the Bible. Cardinal Ratzinger, later Pope Benedict, said once that it wasn't coincidence, but divine providence, that the Son of God became incarnate at a time and place when philosophy had made enough progress that people could have a solid understanding of what had occurred. Having praised philosophy both for its ability to give us access to God without revelation and for its ability to help us understand revelation, let me now end with a reminder again that it has its limits. St. Augustine compared the philosopher without faith to a traveler who is on the top of a hill, and who can, from there, catch a glimpse of where he needs to go. But he can't figure out how to get there. Only through revelation as a guide can we actually find the right path. So I think that Augustine or Aquinas would say this: philosophy is important, but it's not enough to tell you everything you need to know. Thanks.
Could you just go over again why Aquinas' argument isn't susceptible to the domino chain of events objection?
Yeah, so what about the domino chain of events? I'm trying to figure out how not to give the 20-minute answer to that question. In a domino series of causes, each thing, when it does its thing, it's done. And there's no reason to believe that it exists anymore. So if the kind of causal series that Aquinas was wondering about was like that, then at most it would prove that God had existed at one time. But that's not the conclusion he's shooting for. There's more to it than that, but I mean, that's what I said in the talk.
And to me, that just makes it sound like he's discounting the domino chain as a possibility, as opposed to like explaining why it must.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Good. Okay. So if we knew that the causal series wasn't the domino style, then we'd be good. Mm-hmm. But how do we know that it's not the domino kind? Is that a way of putting it?
Yes.
Good. That's a good way of putting it. All right. Aquinas thinks that each of the causes, its ability to act as a cause, is dependent on its being acted upon. So it can't do its thing unless it's being acted on, which is not what the domino thing is like. And so then you just have to ask yourself whether there are in the world causal series that are like that. So I tried to rig up my heating coil in the water tank example so it would work like that. Like Aquinas' example is the hand and the stick and the rock. And of course, somebody's always going to say, well, if you shove the rock hard enough and the table is smooth enough, it's going to keep skittering, right? So that's why I came up with, because then it looks like the causation is still happening even though, you see? So that's why I tried to create the water tank example, which I think is better. Or like if you have a string, if you have like a weight on a string and you're swinging around, as soon as you cut that string, it starts going in a straight line. It doesn't like keep curving for just a little bit more. But you're asking a good question, right? Because you can distinguish the kind of causal series, but then you have to make sure that you've got the kind that you want.
So, I guess I'm wondering, why should we think there are the causal series like the essentially ordered ones at all? So, I mean, even like the stick example, right? There aren't perfectly rigid sticks. So, you know, if I start moving a stick here and I've got a stone over there, it would violate relativity for the stone to start moving when my hand started moving. So even Aquinas' own example, right, that there's a way of thinking simultaneous causation for Aquinas that just doesn't seem like it's our model of causation then.
I don't know enough. What little I knew about relativistic physics, I have forgotten. But I mean, that's an interesting question. My hunch is that the sense in which simultaneity comes into question in relativity theory isn't a sense that would cause problems for Aquinas, but that's a hunch. And a hunch is not an argument.
Yeah, it's just that if you think that it's not my hand moving now that's making the rock move now,
right?
It's my hand having moved whatever kind of thing sound ago.
Yeah.
The rock that's moving the rock. So it's more like a human.
No, that's
kind
that's
of sequential causation than simultaneous. I mean, even you know, if you buy that it takes time for force to travel.
Yes. In that case, part of the issue is that when we think of that example, and like, I mean, it's not a great example. I mean, you can sort of tell what Aquinas is driving at from the example, and in that sense, it's a good example. But I don't think it actually fulfills the requirement that he wants. In that sense, it's not a good example.
I don't think it's a coil of water either, right?
Why?
Because it's going to be the same sort of thing.
Right? Oh!
Sequential thing is going
to lead to
the heating of the water.
I do think the point... You're coming at this in a way that I haven't thought about before. This is a nice twist on this. I don't think the point is so much that the cause, that the result has to come from the cause instantaneously. I don't think that's the crucial point. The more important point is that the cause has to keep causing. It's because the second cause is a cause because it's getting caused. If there's a little time lag in there, I think that maybe is okay. So in that sense, I don't think that the time lag issue is decisive. But I like that line of questioning. Thank you.
So I'm curious, we've been talking about Aquinas, and he was alive, what, 1200 something, so a long time ago. And of course, at the time, people didn't know about gravity, people didn't know about evolution, people didn't know about any of the sciences that we know today that can explain a lot of these immovable, moving things, right? You get gravity started once and things will keep on moving without anyone pushing anything. So my curiosity is, what has happened since then? I mean, the argument has all been about Aquinas, that is a very old argument. What is the new argument to put with things that we know nowadays, that no hand is moving the sun around the earth?
Yeah.
What is the new argument for?
Yeah, good. So, let me see. One point that I want to make, sorry, there's a few points, hang on. Give me a second. Okay, so a really interesting and important question when you're dealing with a philosopher like Aquinas is which aspects of his philosophy just keep staying correct and which turn out to be tied, sort of fatally tied to false stuff, scientific stuff. Sometimes he'll just give an example, but you can easily find a new example. So you say, well, that's a really comical example, whatever. And you just move on, it's easy as pie. Other times you're not so sure, right? So there's this difficulty of whether, and sometimes it would take creative philosophical work to disentangle the philosophical principles from the examples that he gave, right? So the way to do that would be, which I haven't tried to do it here, would be to work in detail. You're like outlining a great philosophical project, right? So you take the principles and you figure out what the principles are, and then you say, okay, hand, stick, rock, that's not a good example. The specific point about things moving, right, like things moving, if we can just go with Newton for a minute. Things moving in a straight line, they just keep moving, right? You don't have to keep pushing them, okay? Now, one way to respond to that is to say, actually, Aquinas can be updated to handle that. You just say, when something is moving in a straight line in a constant velocity, that's not a case of change. It's a kind of stasis. When it's curving, that's a change. And in fact, you do need things to keep making a curve. Okay, well, I said Newton, right? So it gets more complicated. Yeah. Okay. So that's the project, right? You take the principles, and if the principles look good, then you say, you can't, and this is important, right? Because if you don't try to check out the science, then you're just, what do I want to say? I don't know. You have to check it against reality, right? It's not just a conceptual system. But I didn't try to do all that stuff, right? Because mostly I'm just trying to give an example of how Aquinas works. If it turned out that this argument from change and unchanged change doesn't work, you can just go, darn, that one looked really good for a few hundred years, but it turns out it's not a good argument. Then you can just drop it. He's got other arguments. And being willing to drop arguments is a really important philosophical thing. So I didn't come into like sell the first way as like the last. I think it's got a lot of life in it, but maybe not in the end. That's a possibility. There are other arguments that seem better to me, but they're harder to explain.
I was excited at the end that you mentioned that Aquinas addressed the idea that there could be multiple gods, or that he's proved in 50 pages or something, you said that there were not multiple gods.
Yeah.
Just because I was, when I saw the title of your talk, Does God Exist? I was wondering why the title of your talk wasn't Do Gods Exist?
Right.
And from listening to your talk, there was nothing that I heard in your talk that doesn't allow for multiple gods or allow for...
That's absolutely correct.
Yeah, the Greek gods. I know you said that it's complicated and it's 50 pages,
sure.
But could you give us a snippet as to why there couldn't be a Greek...
Well, it takes Greek 50 gods years... It takes him 50 pages to get to it. He doesn't spend 50 pages on it. He doesn't spend 50 pages on anything. That's one of the things that makes Aquinas so hard to read, is he's so compact. Like, it's like 50 words and it's over. And then you just have to figure out what it meant. I think Aquinas would say that it can't possibly be true. I mean, if God is like an unmoving mover and things like that, then by the Greek gods, if what you mean is like the people whose antics we read about in Homer, you just say that can't possibly be right. And you see that already in the Platonic dialogues, right? Socrates is saying to people like, these are really cool stories, but do you think they're true? Like, is that your point? You already have this war between philosophers and the poets, right? This is a classic thing. Now, why would Aquinas say, I can give you a very, very quick and dirty, thinned out version of his argument why there only has to be one God. Because God, the way he understands God being perfect, is God has, it's not just that God is, okay, wait, there's two kinds of perfection, okay? One kind of perfection is that there's a kind of thing that you are, and you fulfill that kind completely. So for example, think of if you go bowling, and you roll 300. You can't do better than that. It's called a perfect game, right? That's exactly the right expression. But there's a lot more reality out there than there is bowling a perfect game. I mean, probably if you did it, it doesn't feel like that at that moment. But actually, there's a lot of things you haven't done. For example, you haven't played the French horn. There's just a whole lot of reality that has not been used up. God is not perfect merely in that sense, but every kind of existence that there could possibly be, God has it in its fullest form. Now, if that's right, then there couldn't be two. Because if there were two, they would have to be different from each other. And one would have to have something that the other didn't have, and then neither of them would be perfect. Well, at least one of them wouldn't, you see? So that's, in a nutshell, how the argument goes.
Well, but three people could get a 300 in bowling. There are three people who could have perfect scores. There are
that's
groups
right.
that operate with consensus.
That's the other kind of perfection. You can have more than one thing that's perfect of a kind. But each of those perfect games, let's say you roll one on Tuesday and I roll one on Wednesday. Yours has a feature that mine doesn't, namely that it was rolled on Tuesday. Mine has a feature that yours doesn't. Mine was rolled on Wednesday. So they're still different from each other.